Thank you so much, choir. I trust that you know what you just heard. If you've heard that anthem before, you know those words were found scrawled on a wall where during the World War II Holocaust era, someone who had been in hiding for a long, long period of time had scrawled these words where they were hiding, and they were found later. That makes that anthem so much beautiful. You're not very often going to hear me say, hey, go ahead and read that while I'm preaching. Go ahead and read those words again while I'm preaching. It'll be fine because it's better than the sermon that I had written probably. Care deeply. In our series, that's the element of the weekly benediction we come to today. And everyone would vote for the notion, care deeply. Who couldn't get on board with the idea that caring deeply is something that Christ modeled and seemed to want us to do? We don't need to commission a special group to look into the concept. Care deeply just sounds right, doesn't it? But then we put a parable with it, like the one Mike just read for us, as Jesus told this story to respond to one who had come to him with a question in Luke chapter 10. We put a parable like that with it, or real life stories, and we're reminded of another truth. Life is, in many ways, a little easier if we don't care too deeply. Keep a little distance. Don't get involved. Stay detached. We're less likely to get burned that way. And suddenly caring deeply can become intrusive to any of us. Each of us has a fine line across which we step into our farthest discomfort. There could be a dozen manifestations of goodness that you would be willing to do, but a story, a parable like this one, or a real life situation or need that pops up right in front of you could cause you to find the 13th one, that line across which if you step, you are into extreme discomfort. You are far out of your zone. So let's turn this parable around a time or two and look at it. This story came about because of a question. And the question itself sounds innocuous enough, but Luke lets us peek over his shoulder and back 2,000 years in time. Just before the question was asked, the writer cut us in on some insider information. The question was posed by a lawyer or a scribe, I think it's better understood, to test Jesus. This was no innocent question born of inquisitive learning or a yearning to mature a faith. But that's okay. In Luke 10:51, we're going to see Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem as he confronts his destiny and leans toward his date with the cross. His answer to this question was cloaked but calculated. He knew what was coming. Now, we Southerners love to handle things passive-aggressively if we can. So this question that was posed to Jesus is right up our alley. Oh, by the way, when is a question not a question? When it's really a statement that you're making. And this question was a statement. What must I do to inherit eternal life? Its purpose was essentially to call out Jesus and entrap him with the inevitable answer that the scribe and his friends just knew Jesus would give. Except that what he gave back to the scribe was to guide the fellow to his own answer from within the Torah, the words of Moses. Safe from a technical standpoint, but true from a gospel standpoint. Words that would stand up in the Hebrew court, but that also gave Jesus a platform to tell us all again what was really important. What you may also remember is that when it was all over, you heard this just a few minutes ago, Jesus looked at the one sent to trip him up and asked, which of these three do you think was a neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? And the scribe said to him, well, the one who showed him mercy. And Jesus said to him, "Then go and do likewise." Douglas John Hall, a scholar, says that anyone who's asked to state the essence of Christianity, and in today's religiously pluralistic culture, we're all asked to testify as to what we think is the essence of Christianity on a daily basis by friends, neighbors, loved ones, co-workers who may not share this faith with us. Hall says that if Christians are asked to tell what they think is the essence of Christianity, then if they point to this parable that Jesus gave in today's scripture, that's not a bad answer. They wouldn't be wrong, he says. But he also goes on to say, unfortunately, such familiarity, because we know this parable, such familiarity, as the saying goes, can also breed a certain amount of contempt. For there is a tendency to reduce the parable to simplistic conclusions like, be nice like the Samaritan and not negligent like the clergy were. And so we do that when we read this parable and then we move on. Well, let's be real. The kind of goodness shown in this parable is a conclusion reached and a chosen act of kindness, but not likely without some consideration. And that might be the element of this that allows us to cozy up to the truth found in this parable. And we need to remember that it is a parable and not an actual narrative story. That may be the central thing that allows us to look at this parable and say, I can do that, rather than just walk away feeling guiltier than before we read it and paralyzed by the size of the assignment. For how many of us would, when coming up on such a situation as the injured one laying on the side of the road, not roll our eyes or groan or even reach back and pull out our favorite naughty word and just mumble it under our breath? Or as Hall says, the unfortunate one in the ditch represents just as much of a nuisance to the Samaritan as to the two religious ones that didn't stop. Who among us could truthfully say that we would come upon the one in Jesus' parable who's in the ditch and say, oh great, this is fabulous. This guy has been beaten severely and robbed and left for dead. I was headed somewhere important, but now I get to fail in my responsibility. And that's going to be great because now I get to do my good deed for the day and take care of this complete stranger. No, that's not what any of us would do. For any of us, the stranger beaten and left on the side of the road is an inconvenience and an intrusion. And to treat him any differently as readers of this parable is to render the story irrelevant. It's just that in Jesus' parable, the Samaritan pushed on past that all too real reaction and dealt out unthinkable goodness. You see what I said earlier about needing to turn this parable every which way in order to not miss out on its riches? In fact, just as an aside, let me assure you, the next time I preach this parable, I can promise you we're going to take off in a completely different direction, because there are a lot of them. And it occurs to me that we cannot fully understand the parable until we've examined it with sensitivity to all the players that are in it and look at their vantage points. Until we've put ourselves into the priest's shoes, into the Levite's shoes, we won't have a chance to understand why they might not have stopped. We might still conclude that their lack of compassion is disappointing, reprehensible even, but we also might have some sympathy. And next time, I might also point out that there are actually two good people in this parable. For some innkeeper was going about his or her day, doing normal things at work, and suddenly a good Samaritan brings in one who has been robbed and beaten and left horribly injured and said, I'm going to place this person under your care, I'm going to pay you, and I'm going away for a few days. I'll come back and pay you later. Take care of him. And to the point of the parable, it seems that the innkeeper would have been willing to do this. It'll be just them and the beaten up guy for a few days, it seems. And so the innkeeper went above and beyond, even if compensated for their trouble. And until we've walked around and asked ourselves what it would be like to be the one who was beaten and left on the side of the road, we haven't truly explored this parable either. We jump to the Samaritan's goodness so quickly that we don't consider how horrifying it might have been to wake up that physically injured but still alive. What it would be like to wake up in that much pain, yet with gratitude that you're still alive and inspired by someone's goodness that saw to your care even though you were a complete stranger. But also to wake up and feel the awkwardness that you are now so utterly dependent upon other people to take care of your basic needs for a time. And that you will be beholden to them when your pride and independence might make this way out of your comfort zone. That's the texture of this parable that we have to admit. And we haven't turned this parable in all its possible directions until I consider that on my worst day and in the deepest darkness that resides in me, I might be the one who put him in the ditch on the side of the road in the first place. To wonder what goes on inside a person that would make that kind of violence possible and make that an option to do that to someone. And until I've considered some of these kinds of things, I've only walked by this parable at a safe distance. But today our assignment is to focus on the one who cared deeply. We need to learn from him. So let's dive back in with another practical matter. The extent of Jesus' parable can be a little off-putting. Now, by that I mean we have to admit that what the Good Samaritan did in today's culture is a good way to end up on the 6 o'clock news. Carjackers and gang members are setting up fake scenes that look like need, but they give the person a chance to distract you and rob and beat you instead. We are scared of being the only one or the first one to stumble upon an accident scene. Yet that can happen. And you're going to have to, and I'm going to have to use my judgment and common sense. I'm not advocating that we live recklessly. Besides, it's not the only way we should understand this parable. Like so much of our biblical scripture, let's don't get caught up in taking this parable so literally that we don't get around to taking it seriously enough. There are little and big ways in which our compassion and action can be needed on any day, every day, and that aren't necessarily dangerous at all, but they are important to the person that is so profoundly in need. Seminary students and professors love to say that ministry happens in the interruptions. And philosophically, that's nice until it's your schedule that gets blown out of the water. Interruptions are still that. Interruptions. But as Jesus' story in the Gospels will illustrate, some of life's most unexpected and best surprises begin with an unscheduled calamity or an awkward, quiet knock at the door. I mentioned a few weeks ago in my introduction to our short parable series that Jesus often used exaggeration in these teaching stories, his parables. Well, to his audience, combining the words good and Samaritan were an exaggeration. They were an unthinkable combination. And so as Jesus would have taught with this parable, the shock of his audience would have been palpable, but is so completely lost on us. And yet he must have meant to do so. And so he also must have meant that these teachings applied to everyone, including you and me, in our time. And the Samaritan wasn't good, because he was dumb enough to say, "Oh wow, someone needs me right now. It's really going to cost me. This is great." Samaritans disliked Jews just as much as Jews disliked them. And whatever he was on his way to do was just as important as anything anybody else was out to do that day, probably, in this parable. No, he was good. He was good because he did the right thing. That's it. Pure and simple. Peter Gomes was for years a professor at Harvard Divinity School and the minister of Harvard's Pusey Memorial Church. And he writes on Jesus' stories and notes that in one survey of younger folks in today's culture, they were asked why Jesus might not appeal to that generation as much as Jesus has appealed to previous generations. And one respondent, one high school student, said, "Well, according to what I've read in the Bible, Jesus was a wimp. He would never make it in the average American high school today," the respondent suggested. "So trying to do what Jesus did is either impossible as he was the Son of God, or it's undesirable because in the real world, it appears to some of us that he just wasn't a winner." Well, any mature believer knows that the opposite is actually true. That there are times when Jesus assigning us to be people of compassion, of care, calls from deep within us the fiercest choices and some of the toughest loving choices that we could possibly need to make. Loving acts of compassion can bring together the unlikeliest of players too. People doing the right thing can change the world forever, or at least the world around them. It begins with a changed heart that has enough room for love that is not mailed in. A humbled heart whose beginning and ending place is the knowledge that we're all in this together. Did you hear Steve mention that earlier? A care that is not merely spoken, not just felt or thought about. A care that rises up out of who we are such that we have to do the right thing. My first full week up here, I had already discovered what we now call at our house the shortcut. I'm talking about Stewart Drive in front of Bronco that connects College Drive with Bailey and puts you out over beside Lowe's. And I was out running errands that first week that I was here, and one day I was headed toward college on Stewart. And up ahead I could see two misplaced vehicles and a lot of debris in the road. There had obviously been an accident. The accident was so fresh that no law enforcement, no first responders had arrived yet. And unlike our lone and beaten character in Jesus' parable, though, there were a few people, quite a few people, who had already stopped with the accident. It seems that a young girl in a car had pulled out and broadsided a man in a large pickup truck. And best I could tell, no one was injured in the accident, although the accident itself had been pretty bad. It was clearly her fault. And sitting on a curb was an inconsolable young Caucasian woman. Her body shook as she cried. She had been the driver who had pulled out and caused the accident. She may have been going into shock or at the very least a panic attack based on how she was shaking. And holding her in his arms was a large African-American man, the driver of the pickup truck. The one who had been minding his business when he got hit. He had every right to be more than upset, and instead he held her as if she were his own child as she sobbed out her grief and distress. I have never forgotten what I saw that day. Surfing through life detached from all that goes on around you, not investing in others, not risking your care, choosing to tune into the more legalistic parts of the Bible and ignoring the grace and love-filled parts. That's an easier way to live. Jesus' way is messier and will cost us way more In the end, though, I think Jesus was trying to tell us that it's far more rewarding His way. And here's the thing. Even if your moment of goodness, my moment of compassion, did begin with a roll of the eyes, a deep and exasperated sigh, it's the act that matters. Love that matters is a verb. It's action. Compassion that only feels or talks falls short. Sympathy that doesn't express itself helpfully doesn't connect. Each of us is called by the Almighty to be people of love. Just so we're clear, I'll say it again. As you are going, care deeply. We stand and sing a song just now, hymn number 519. It's called Sent Forth by God's Blessing. If you have a response that these words guide you in, then sing that song right where you are. But if you have a response that means you need to come down here to the front, I'll be waiting for you. If you want to join your life with our church, I'll be here to receive you. Let's stand just now as we sing together.